Pausing with her hand on the lid of the box, Mama Jane met our eyes and drank us in. I realized I was leaning so far forwards I was close to toppling on my face. Whatever Mama was thinking, she decided to proceed and lifted the lid. Jacob stood on tiptoes to peer inside, but I was too short to see. All I could see was the green velvet interior of the case, and Mama Jane carefully lowered her hands inside the box. She was so tender lifting the contents out. At first I thought it was a newborn baby. As I got my first good look, I found myself disappointed. It was just a plain doll made out of a Hessian sack. It had black button eyes and a stitched-on smile made from black thread. It didn't have hands, hair, or any clothing. I couldn't see why Mama Jane was so excited about this boring doll until she placed it down. Rather than crumpling to the floor like every other doll I'd ever seen, it remained upright as Mama Jane took her hands away. Even though it was bent forwards with its arm almost touching the carpet, it didn't fall over. Even my childlike grasp of physics told me this was strange, though I didn't understand why. Then it began to move. It lifted its Hessian arms and straightened, standing completely upright. When it clapped its little stumps together, Mama Jane started laughing in her great, big, booming way that meant something was truly delighting her. We'd seen puppets before, but they had strings. It was a game that we chose to play along with. This was something else. This was real magic. Hello again, and welcome back to the Guild Podcast, the podcast for the Writers, Artists, and Readers Guild. I am your host, Chris Mary Holtzman, and I am delighted that you have chosen to stop by here again. Our guest today is Ryan Hunt, brother of Joel R. Hunt, who we had a while back. And it's kind of fun to see and talk to two brothers and see if they have the same ideas and thoughts about writing. But it's also an interesting journey that we talk about, Ryan and I, about creating writing, you know, being creative, having a team with you, having readers, and everything that we find to be important. So it's real fun. We talk a lot about lockdown too, and especially now as lockdown might be increasing for a lot of people. And it's unfortunate, and it's kind of sad, but it's the same here where I am. So anyway, that is that. There might be some exciting news coming up in the future, but I'm going to hold off on that for a bit until we know for sure. So anyway, let's jump right in to the interview with Ryan Hunt. Ryan Hunt, welcome to the Guild Podcast. How are you doing today?
Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, well, as I briefly mentioned, I might be COVID positive, but we're doing this virtually, so I should be able to scrape through.
Yeah, we'll see. You'll have to keep us updated.
Find out tomorrow, so fingers crossed.
So did you took the test?
No, I haven't. It's my wife. So she gets tested at work. She was 0.1 of a degree over their threshold. Got the test, but then her boss has tested positive. So it's milling around. So there's a high chance that it could be.
So is it a blood test or is it a nose test?
They do 10 seconds in the mouth. It's actually self-administered, which I thought was really strange. So they give you the pack, you have to wind the window down an inch. They give you this little pack. You have to swab it around your mouth for 10 seconds. You have to actually tickle your tonsils. That's what they say. And then you have to basically stick up your nose for 15 seconds. And then you put it in a little pot and it goes in a biohazard bag and it gets shipped away.
The same one? The same one you put in your mouth and then you put it in your
mouth. Yeah.
I like that. I tested a couple of weeks ago because I was like the first week of school, I came down with, sore throat, fever and everything like that. So I was just like, I got it. But I went in the same day, actually, as I booked the test, because that's what you do here. You kind of go through the internet, you book a test, and then you go to the hospital. Yeah, and then you go into this room where a guy in a hazmat suit, checks your ID and everything.
Oh, really? Full hazmat suit.
Yeah, full suit. And then he, so I'm just sitting there and I'm waiting. I'm sitting in this chair and he comes close to me and he takes out this long Q-tip looking thing and then shoves it right into my nose. And I'm trying to like avoid it, but he puts his hand on the back of my head and just continues
digging in.
And it feels like he's in the stem of my brain.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, because I don't think I could do that to myself.
No, well, it said on this test, because I think that's why it's self-administered. I think so many people must have complained. I think that's why you get to do it to yourself. But obviously the risk there is that you don't go far enough.
No, exactly.
You're not going to want to, are you? You're not going to want to make... My wife had to sort of like make herself gag, basically, to tickle these tonsils. I was just sitting there thinking, I'm glad I don't have to do this. But like so far, I'm symptom-free. She just... We keep checking her fever every now and then. She's been all right, occasionally having the odd spike. So we'll have to see. It's Schrodinger's COVID at the minute.
Yeah, it's a good one. That's so what happens, because the new rules that came in here in Sweden, like just on Monday, is that if anybody has COVID, everybody in the household has to stay at home. It wasn't like that before. You could actually go out even if you weren't infected.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. How is it now? No, I mean, is it the same?
I think if you grab 10 British people off the street right now and ask them what the rules are in their area, I think you get 10 different answers. there's local restrictions happening all over the country. And I think there's a lot of confusion about what to do. But I think the general rules are if you or somebody in your household's got it, I think you've just got to sort of self-isolate.
Yeah.
And then all the myriad of different rules are about going, you know, I think we're not supposed to mix households at the minute, I think.
I was talking to somebody from, I think, Australia, and they're not allowed to go travel, like, further than 5 kilometers from where they live, from their domicile.
Okay.
So, yeah. I mean, it's just crazy everywhere.
It's interesting to see all the different strategies and how and what works. My wife was asking me about the Black Plague yesterday. She has got all these questions, but I don't think people are traveling quite as far there, but it's still spread all across
Europe. So. There's many theories of why it spread with lice and rats and whatever. Mm-hmm. But obviously, I think the Black Plague was a lot deadlier. I think you got it on the Monday and you were dead by Wednesday.
Yeah. Yeah. touch wood this Sunday. Yeah, we'll be doing that. But I think it's almost a mixed blessing that it seems to doesn't affect children and young people, in that makes it spread more. But at least, you know, we know who to protect. And can you imagine how much more chaotic this would have been if it was, you know, affecting kids the same as it's affecting.
I don't think that our society could have handled that, because obviously parents would have to be home with their kids, because you wouldn't have any schools open, you wouldn't have any daycare open. I mean, I think the most countries would shut down completely because people just couldn't go to work.
Yeah.
They had to stay home and take care of the kids, and all the schools would close. So it's a weird time to be living in, and you'd think that we'd be getting out of it by this time, but it just keeps rolling on.
Yeah, it's the slow, steady steamroll, isn't it?
How's it been doing for your creativity?
To be honest with you, it was kind of, in the early days, it boosted it, because it was almost like that, okay, here's a good opportunity to get up and go. And I've been working from home all the way throughout, really, and so has my wife. Well, my wife, actually, she's been going working as normal, really. She was busier than ever. I was taking on overtime to get lots of schemes through. So I work in highways. And obviously, whilst the road networks were quiet, they wanted to just basically do everything they've been waiting years to do and just get it all booked in. So we've been quite busy. But basically, from lockdown is when I started this project that I'm doing at the moment. Mm. Which was sort of, I do a short story a month and release that on my website, and it's all in a shared world. And I've just sort of stuck to that program and been doing my book in the sidelines. And there's been moments where I haven't been able to do as much as I wanted to, but because I've got that key deadline to aim for every month, it's worked quite well, to be honest.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit about that project, because, I mean, it's an interesting project, and where you got the idea And
yeah,
there's a lot of things to unpack on that.
So I've always liked short stories and horror stories and stuff like that. And this originally started, I used to sort of like dabble in writing screenplays and stuff.
Mm.
And so this started as just a little project for myself, really, more than anything. But have you ever heard of SCP?
No, I don't.
It stands for Secure, Contain, Protect. And it's almost like an internet project. It's like an internet writing project that sort of anyone can contribute towards it, but it gets approved by sort of, I think there's, I don't know exactly how it works anymore because it's got that out of, you know.
Okay.
There's all these interesting entries about these anomalous items that they're essentially dangerous or spooky or creepy or whatever. And some of them you can see inspiration from like Doctor Who and all these different things. And anyway, I fell in love with a few of them. And so as a sort of hobby interest, I just started thinking, oh, this would be a brilliant TV show if you stuck them all together and sort of followed people finding them.
Okay.
And it sort of grew legs and sort of started as this fan fiction. And then I started adding my own items in. And before I knew it, it wasn't really about that at all. It was a completely different beast. And so I decided to move away from that and completely separate everything from it and see where it went, really.
Yeah.
And where it went was Floor 54, which is, I think anyone who's familiar with SCP will be able to see that it's inspired heavily by it. Mm. The idea being that there's this secret government organization that hides all the secrets of the world away. So gods, vampires, magic, it's all been real at some point and squashed down by humanity and stuck on a level in this ministry vault. So like level one is dead gods that are entombed, you know.
So
decrease in severity, basically, all the way down to floor 54, which is the bottom floor, which is everything that doesn't fit. It's the things they can't categorize. And things are kept there secret to be studied and learned from, really. And so each month is a story of a normal person finding something unusual. And then at the same time, you get a ministry report as after the story's happened of the ministry finding this item and sort of containing it and doing their preliminary, you know, this is what it is, this is what it does for further study. So it's almost like a double whammy. That's the idea behind it.
Okay, yeah, it's cool. I mean, it reminds me, there used to be, I wonder if there were two, there used to be like I want to say Canadian TV show, or maybe it was just on Sci-Fi. I'm thinking, yeah. I want to say that the quality of the effects were so poor that it was either Canadian or a sci-fi channel special. It was called Warehouse 13.
Yes. So Joel told me about this. So Joel, this is when I was telling him about the idea. He said, oh, there's a TV show that's like this that you should check
but
out.
It's not quite like that because all the artifacts already kind of basically exist.
Yes.
And I think in Warehouse 13, they like either they escape or somebody tries to steal something like that. It's not quite similar. I like the premise, but I said like I could only watch like the first season because the effects are so poor.
Yeah. I watched a few episodes of it, and it seems I sometimes call it off. It's like I don't. If anyone's a fan, I don't want to obviously offend anyone, but it's like almost like filler telly. It's like you can sort of enjoy it and watch it. I can't imagine you're going to get anyone who would go, "That's my favorite show of all time ever." do you know what I mean? But you will get people who go, "Oh, you know, I quite like that show. That was my cup of tea. I quite like it. It was quite casual."
Yeah.
You know, fun show.
Because it never aired here.
Mm.
So I actually had, I downloaded it. So then I already felt like there was a commitment there. I have to watch this because I've downloaded it. So that was, it also, there's another one. And this one I think is Canadian, but I cannot for the life of me remember what it is. But it's like a secret society and they keep, but I think it's only kind of like, you know, Gorgons and the Fae and stuff like that in this building. And this person, he becomes an agent for that organization and he sees it all. It's also like the production is horrendous.
Is it?
But I cannot for the life. It's called like Sanctuary, I think.
Okay. You have to, well, if you do remember what it is, you have to let me know.
I will, but as I, like, I could only watch one episode of that one.
I imagine most of the shows, and mine too, will be sort of inspired by X-Files and shows like that as well, sort of the Men in Black, sort of that sort of premise originally as well.
Yeah, and I think those, and I think it's fun to play off of those, and this, and especially because I'm thinking Floor 54, and I'm thinking of like Room. I think there's a show called like Room something, Room 109 or something like that.
Yeah, Room 101, isn't there?
That's what it is. And I like that kind of episodic, that idea of a self-contained story in a world where there's a lot around. You know, there could be more. Yeah. I mean, Warehouse 13 is kind of like that. It's all about one artifact or one thing, but then there's an overarching story, which is more or less interesting. I don't know, but I mean, I like that idea, and I think one can do a lot with it.
That's what I've quite liked about it, because I've sort of dabbled with writing for the past 4 years, and I finished a novel that I tried to put out, but it's almost like, until you've got a reason for readers to stick around, you're essentially just calling out into the void, aren't you? No one knows who anyone is until they've got a bit of work behind them. Mm. And the beauty with a brand like this, or a shared world, whatever it is that you can just keep building on it and building on it and adding to it. And even if you know, one day I can put it down for a while, I can pick it back up, or I can launch a full series based off the back of this, but it's always there, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you've almost got that launch pad to sort of build an audience from, build a bit of, you know.
Yeah, and prep, I think in a way you don't suffer as much from writer's fatigue.
No.
At the same time, because there's always interesting. And I mean, the novel that I put out, my debut novel that I put out in July, was kind of like the same thing. It was just a project. It was only supposed to be like a lyrical exercise. It wasn't meant to ever be a story. It was just like, you know, I need something to dabble with or doodle with.
Yeah.
While I'm not inspired to write my actual work and project.
Yeah, definitely.
But then it took over. Like all these characters, I mean, because actually my book is based originally on a couple of sketches that a guy named Tim Ellis did, where he combined two Golden Age superheroes, like public domain superheroes. He put them together and he made like one superhero.
Which one is it?
Well, he put together The Face.
Okay.
I don't know if you know who The Face is. He was a guy dressed in a suit, and he had like a mask that was horrific, that just scared the crap out of people. That was his superpower. So yeah, he had like oriental mask that it would be the face. And then the original Daredevil.
Okay, that's cool.
Which was a figure that threw like boomerangs and had like a multicolored suit and a spike belt. So he put them together and created Death Mask. And I just like, well, maybe I'll write something around that, because I thought that was fun. And then he created a supervillain. So he had all these characters that he had just like, he just basically threw things together. And I was just like, I'll build on that.
It's really cool having that foundation though, isn't it?
Yeah.
To be able to build upon and keep exploring and sort of taking different directions.
Exactly. And then since it's all public domain, and he was just like, you know what, I'm just doing this for fun, so do whatever you want with them.
Yeah.
And then the story kind of evolved from that. And it's actually not about this kind of superhero character. It's more about the characters around him.
Yes.
And how a society deals with when a vigilante steps in and tries to do social justice.
So is the hero the villain in yours? So
no, he's not. He's just like, he's actually just a bit character that turns the, there is a real villain in it that both the police and the state and the police are trying to fight, and this vigilante is like keeps getting in their way, and they don't know what the hell his deal is, because he just goes around murdering people with these wavy swords that he inherited in Bali. So it's just like, it just kind of grew into this, and I was always thinking like, nobody's gonna want to publish this because it's weird. It's like supernatural crime fiction. Who's gonna want to publish? But I mean, it was strong enough, I guess, to get published. So
nice. That's sometimes people like stuff they've not seen before, don't they?
Yeah, but how? So how do you keep like inspiration going, and where do you find like when you decide like this month, what are we doing this month?
I always make sure I've got stuff in my back pocket. I never ever like. In fact, normally I quite like having a story written ready to go. So I've got 1 month in hand. And I just got to that point, and then this month I've sort of ruined it because I've sort of been focusing on admin and branding and stuff like that. So I've lost my month advantage, but I've got two stories to go on. It's just the way my brain works is I can't necessarily fight that inspiration. Whichever story interests me more is the one that I've got to explore, because I find that it's very much an uphill battle if you've got two projects on and one of them is more interesting. But that's in a way, that's the beauty of having this shared world, is that even if that happens, it can still be within the parameters that I've set out for myself. So, so I've got a whole massive folder structure where I've got just literally one sentence ideas. I've got some that I know would be good, like novelettes or short stories. Like there's one, for example, it's these deep sea divers find an anchor, and whenever you touch the anchor, they get transported to a desert, and it's just them, and they look around, and then they take their hands away, they're back. And it's basically a portal into another dimension, but whenever you're touching the portal, your world stops. So whoever run around the divers, the diver that touched it just instantly pulled his hand back as if he got burnt by it. And so obviously the Ministry of Secrets take it to Floor 54, where it's studied. And they find that they take these almost like exploration teams to drag the anchor across the desert to explore this second world. And eventually they find people, and these people have put the anchor out there to get rid of it, basically.
Okay.
But it's almost you've got these competing agendas, because when we're in their world, we're pausing ours. And when they touch it, then they can come to our world, but their world's paused. So it's almost that it becomes a bit of a tug of war in a way.
Well, that's cool. I like that idea. Where do you find the inspiration for those kind of things? Because I was almost thinking like as I said, like with Warehouse 13 and this, I think Sanctuary or whatever. I mean, they're based on real mythology and lore.
I've got to be honest.
There
are some. So, for example, I listened to a Neil Gaiman's. He did his mythology one, which is about Norse mythology.
Yeah.
And one of the bits I love, because it's just a really fun, almost like you sat around a campfire drinking mead, just telling these cool stories. And one that I really liked was where Thor and Loki go to the Hall of the Giants.
Yeah.
And the Giants, it's got a name like Loki. I can't remember his name now off the top of my head.
No, yeah. Anyway. Well, actually, in Swedish, he's also called Loki, but he has a name before. He's called Utbygda Loki.
Uta Loki or something like that?
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's just because he lives in this area, so he's like that Loki.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah,
but he tricks them all. He gets tricks them into a drinking competition. Thor's drinking, trying to finish this thing, and he's like, any giant can finish this in one gulp. So prove you're a giant. And so he starts drinking, and as much as Thor likes drinking, he can't finish it. And he keeps trying, but no matter how hard he tries, he can't finish the drink. But in the end, he sort of like pulled this trick over them, and Thor was actually trying to drink the oceans of the world.
Yeah.
And so he's lowered it. He's made a good dint in these oceans. When they go back, you know, there's where they came on sea is now pure beaches with all these fish flopping around. But so this drinking horn is on Floor 54, and if you tip it up, water and fish and everything will start falling out, and you can actually flood the whole chamber just by tipping it upside down. But if you tip it the right way up, it stops water coming out.
There's some weird things in Norse mythology that you don't, I mean, because oftentimes you'll see, I mean, and having studied religion, you know, I have some experience with that. I mean, oftentimes you can see like similar stories coming around, you know, like in Greek mythology, and there are parallels.
Roman particularly.
Yeah, to like
Romans just stole everything from them.
Yeah, but and even like in somewhat in Germanic and like Hispanic, you know, because they also had gods, even though we don't talk about them so much. Spanish gods. And I think there's some real crazy stuff. in Norse mythology.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that story is just great because that's actually like a contained story in itself. It's not like, because you have like the one where Thor fights the serpent, the world serpent. The world serpent. And that's just basically a thing. He goes out and he's going to go fishing with this giant. but the one where he goes, where they go to visit Loki, the other Loki, it's like a whole, I mean, it's a story in itself and a lot of different things that happen.
Yeah.
I mean, because what happens is that his hammer gets stolen, right? Or something like that. That's why they go out there. And then they dress up like women.
So
completely, completely bonkers. I think there is an actual animated movie based on that. That's from Denmark. It's actually quite good. But it's like that's just like, because it's such a crazy story.
Yeah, but a lot of them are like that. That book's really, if you've not read it, it's really fun. I'm really into audiobooks. I basically put one on when I'm walking the dog or when I'm doing chores. And that one's really good. And it's Neil Gaiman's. Is it called Myth?
I think it's called Norse Mythology, isn't it?
It might be. Actually, I'm getting confused with Stephen Fry's Mythos, I think.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing. Mythology. Stephen Fry's stuff is. I listened to his. There was a free audio book. It wasn't an audio book. I think it was. I think it is some form of podcast that he did for Amazon for Audible.
Yeah.
Which was about Victorian England.
Oh, that's a good fit.
And then it's just perfect. It's like a great the one. There's some saucy bits in it, especially when they talk about like eroticism in the Victorian age, and they like read excerpts from real dirty books.
Oh, really?
Like gay pornography. They have like excerpts from some really raunchy stuff.
That's amazing. I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, I think it's called like Victorian Age or Victorian England or something like that. It's a treat to listen to.
I've actually started up my Audible subscription because of you, actually.
So
because of your podcast, the other podcast, the Ease and the Reader one, it made me think, because I've not read Wheel of Time in years, because it made me want to write.
Yeah,
I did write, and then I stopped reading because I was writing. So I've almost lost my place with it. I tried to pick up, I think I've paused on book 9. I tried to pick it up again, you know, like sort of last year. And I found it hard to find my place again. So I thought, I'll get the Audible books and I'll start from the beginning and go through. So, start my subscription and sort of creeping through the Wheel of Time now. So
cool. Very cool. Yeah. So this project is, when it goes to the end of the year, is that what, are you thinking that it's going to
continue? It's just rolling and rolling. So the idea behind it is that for this year at least, 100%, there'll be a month and a report every a story and a report every month. At first, my plan was just to do a piece of content a month. So it might be like a story one month, then a report for that, the previous story the next. But the thing that I quickly realized was that if I'm uploading a story onto the internet, no one's going to really remember what it was about the next month.
No.
I can do it to the newsletter, but for the wider audience, you need that initial investment. So I think for the first year at least, it sort of needs to be story and report at the same time. So you've almost got a bonus content at the same time as the actual story. And then once I've got 12, I'll sort of put a free ebook out for year one, hopefully at the same time that I'm going to launch my series, which follows two detectives back in 1988 in this world when it's still establishing.
Okay, yeah.
And where they hunt down the bigger mysteries. So some of the items are just almost like features. You can sum them up in a sentence. Like there's a pair of dice that when you roll them, they will make any number that you're thinking of appear. So if you think of six, it'll, on the dice, the shared number will be six. If you think of a million, you won't be able to see the dots because they'll just be black. So it's like these magic dice. But that's all they do. They appear in one story where a scientist it's her job to just sort of routinely go through these mundane items and just check if there's been any developments.
Yeah, kind of like in James Bond, where you see where Bond talks to Q and you have all these people testing other things in the background.
Definitely. I think that was part of the original idea. The thing that I quite liked was you got this big story following the agents and the people who in their own way are these unique items in how they've been formed and what their wants and desires are. But as they're kind of walking through the corridor of this, it's basically a zoo for weird things. In the background of the TV show, in my mind, you'd have all these items that were from the short stories in the background.
Yeah.
So they might be, as they're walking past, there's a two-seater sofa where people will appear on this sofa and pat the empty seat and encourage you silently to come on and join them. And if you do sit down, you will be the next person to appear on the sofa,
okay,
encouraging the person on. So the idea being is that you've got all these almost like Easter eggs in the background for people, mm-hmm, as the main story is going on. So that's something that's quite exciting for me, because I think I imagine in most writers' minds, you're always thinking, one day this will be a TV show, or one day this will be a, you know. So for that, I think that's what sort of inspires me in a way, is because I've got that, because I can visualize it, I can see the world, mm-hmm, and it's sort of like trying to put it on paper.
And I think that's what, I mean, G.R.R. Martin did with the Game of Thrones or the Song of Ice and Fire. I mean, you can tell if you read the book,
yeah,
the books, this was made to be a TV show.
100%. If you look at even the past with, is Aegon the Conqueror?
Yeah.
That's a whole story. He's got a whole, he knows where he was. He knows what he ate for breakfast 2,000 years ago. Do you know what I mean? He's got it all planned out in his head. Yeah. It's insane what that man does. There's no wonder it takes so long to write the books.
No, exactly. And I think, I mean, because you can, but also he came from TV. I mean, he wrote Twilight Zone, so he knew how to do that. And for me, in my mind, I'm not a big George Martin fan, mostly because I feel like this is, to me, it's like he knows how the fantasy genre works. He knows how a TV show works, and he just took all those elements to make it as attractive as possible for as many readers. Right. To me, it lacks heart in a way.
Oh, really? That's yeah, okay.
I see it more as a product. He created a product that he knew was going to sell.
I can see that. Yeah.
Okay. And if there are any George R. R. Martin fans out there,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Because I do enjoy his. I think he did like a shared universe thing called Wild Cards.
Okay, I've not heard of that.
Way back when there are several books in the series, if I'm not mistaken, and he always like writes the first part. Like the first story, and then there's bunch of other invited writers to write it.
So it seems like a group community.
Yeah, something like that. I've only heard of it. I haven't read them, so I don't really know what the... I mean, I've read the first one, but I haven't read any of the other ones. I did like his... I think it's called... It's like a vampire story that takes place on a riverboat.
Okay, that's cool.
Fever Dream is the name of it. That one was actually quite good.
Okay.
Yeah, so... If you like vampires, you check that one out.
What's not to like, unless they're sparkling?
Exactly, unless they're sparkling. Absolutely. So before you wrote that, you worked on this project, and you said you've been writing for like 4 years or so?
Yeah, so I sort of always had an interest in it, but I didn't really start taking it seriously as a hobby or a passion until it was, I don't know who it was, it was either Joel or my friends. We started like a little writing group. And there was a video by Brendan Sanderson where he says, you know, people play basketball without expecting to be in the NBAs. Why can't you write without expecting to be a published author? And that kind of really put it in perspective of, you know, you can just write for fun. I love writing. And you know, I like exploring the characters. It's like a form of insanity, really, isn't it? Because you're basically having conversations with yourself in your own head in worlds you've made up. But there's a fun to it, and you can almost lose yourself in these worlds you make and the characters that you kind of conjure up. And that kind of really got me going, really. And I think doing it together and critiquing each other's work, learning how to critique and how to take criticism as well, that really all pushed us forwards and made us get into a habit, really.
Mm. Yeah, I can see that, because the whole thing about having conversations with yourself, because I was always kind of like, when I saw the commitments the first time, and I see Jimmy Rabbit in interviewing himself,
yeah,
that's like, that was me when I was younger. I would make up these characters. I had like a whole series. I would assume that it was kind of like a sitcom. I can't remember, where it kind of involved, you know, like a cooler version of myself.
Sure.
And then my crazy friends, and it was kind of like a sitcom. And then, like, I would think out these stories every night when I went to bed. And I think some of them were quite good. And I kind of like a little ashamed. Too bad that they never went anywhere. I never did anything with them. But then I would also, like, when I would take a shower or I would take a bath or whatever, I would interview the characters as the actors playing those characters that I had made up.
That's next level. That's
and I would make up voices different. I mean, they were different voices for different characters. And it also got me to kind of know the characters, because it would be like, well, what were you thinking when this scene was set?
Yeah.
And it was just crazy. And
you're like, yeah, full on interviewing him.
Yeah. I was just like, yeah, that's weird. And it made me, you know, and it was kind of like one day I was just like, no, this series is it has to end.
Because well, you just completely cut it off.
Yeah, no, I cut it off, because I think the idea was that the characters were supposed to exist from starting, like, elementary school, like their first year in school.
Yeah.
And then they were kind of more like Peanuts, you know, like the Snoopy show.
Yeah.
They were kind of like that, or even actually more like Bloom County, if you ever read that.
I'm not familiar with that one, no.
Burke Breathhead is the name of the writer. The main character is like a penguin that lives in this house with a bunch of other people.
No, I'm not. I don't think I've seen that one.
Yeah, there's a crazy cat.
Very familiar with Snoopy. My dad had some old Snoopy books.
So it was kind of like that. And then it kind of like would, as they grew older, obviously the characters had to slightly, as I grew older, the characters grew older with different interests and different relationship to each other. So they became more like 90210.
Yeah.
Or more like Saved by the Bell.
Oh, yeah.
And then at some point, I was just like, well, they're going off to, you know, whatever college or high school, or whatever. So it has to end here.
That's incredible.
So, I mean, well, I think my parents must have thought that I was schizophrenic. Because, I mean, obviously, they could hear me talk.
I was going to say, because my wife catches me talking to myself, because I've always done this, a similar sort of thing where in my head there's these cartoon shows or sketch shows or whatever it is, or I tell myself jokes, and my dad does it as well. My dad will just be up the garden, and you just see him just suddenly laughing to himself. So he obviously runs in the family.
But it's interesting because, I mean, Joel Hunt, who he interviewed here, and I mean, he's your brother. My family is, I mean, we're all creative in our own different way. My youngest sister is an awesome painter. My brother and I have another sister and a brother, and they're fantastic musicians. And they're very creative in that way. And I write. I don't think like there was really, I mean, my dad was a musician, but other than that, there wasn't really that creative vein at home. We were surrounded by music, but not, and we were surrounded by books, but not like, with like, you know, we weren't always encouraged to maybe create. We weren't always encouraged to do this. So, but what do you think it is that made you and Joel so creative?
In a way, I'd say it's each other, because I think we almost bounce off each other in a way, because Joel's definitely the wiser brother, even though he's the younger brother. Joel's the scholar of the two of us, and he's a lot smarter than I am. But when we were kids, I just remember every single game that we'd play or everything that we'd do together, we wanted to, if we couldn't play it, like say, for example, a very early version would be Pokemon. Mm-hmm. So we both completed Pokemon. We played against each other a lot. And then you hit the point where you can't really do much more Pokemon in, because you've kind of done it all. You've caught them all. You've battled them all. You beat all the gym leaders. You can start the game again, but what's the point? So we made our own version of Pokemon and started designing monsters and you know, giving them stats and designing a world. And we got all the neighborhood kids over. And because I was the oldest, I was sort of the leader. And we basically said, right, today we're making a Pokemon game. Draw Pokemon, draw monsters. And so we basically made this rip-off Pokemon game and drew a lame version of Pallet Town and started drawing. It was literally the exact same. It had Viridian Forest above Pallet Town, but it was called something else. You know, and I think in a way we've always emulated things we've liked, and I think that's when it grows. And I don't, going back to the question I never really answered, which was what inspires me, I don't really know. I think it's like an amalgamation of things that I like. And sometimes I'll get clear ideas when I'm walking the dog and I see something, or something will spring into my mind. But very often I can just be driving along. And as an example, so two of the stories I've already done, I thought of in the same 5-minute stretch on a piece of road going downtown. a fax machine that prints the future and a little voodoo doll that copies the movements of whoever touched it last. And that that sort of inspires Jim Shorts right there. So I don't know where it comes from, but it's obviously an amalgamation of things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, I could never play with my brother in that way because my brother is too, my younger brother is way too hyper. I mean, we tried to build we had a whole Lego city in our basement when we were kids with a palace. And I had like all this story all planned out, you know, this is what happens here. He would like just kind of wreck the whole thing by like having the king who lived in the palace, like get drunk and just like drive his car into the local post office. And every time it would go down there, the whole place would be in ruins.
This sounds like the plot to the Lego movie.
I'm sure that's quite kind of like just a general thing that happens.
Yeah, sure.
Between brothers.
That's a very cool, having a Lego city in the basement. It's pretty.
Well, we weren't allowed to have it. My mother would just hated us having our toys out. We would have our toys out all the time. So we had to sit in the basement and then do it. But where was I going with this thought first? I was thinking the all these things that you talked about and you've mentioned, these artifacts, and I mean, it reminds me a lot of, and not, it's not a copy, but it makes me think of Tom Holt. Are you familiar with Tom Holt?
No.
He's a, I guess you'd say like maybe a comedic fantasy, a humorous fantasy author. I assume that you know Terry Pratchett.
Yes.
Since he worked with he's similar to Terry Pratchett, except that his stories are not set in a fantasy world. They're often set in our world, but with fantastic elements. And another writer who's very similar is Robert Rankin, but Rankin's stuff is a lot more erotic or sexualized and extreme. But Tom Holt is very interesting because what he'll do is like his book My Hero, for instance. He imagined that there's a parallel world where all our story characters live. They're like actors. So there's always a hero and he gets called on to play. Or like, oh no, now they're writing this book and I have to go be this guy.
Cool. Yeah, okay.
And then those worlds all of a sudden kind of like meld. So these characters come into our world.
Imagination Land on South Park.
Yeah, and he has a book called one of his first books is called Who's Afraid of Beowulf, which is basically they dig up an old Viking ship somewhere in London, and these Vikings are still alive. They wake up because they're supposed to be woken up when the evil wizard returns. And the thing is that the evil wizard never left. He just became he's the CEO of a global software company.
That makes sense.
Okay. That's how he became. So it's like he was kind of thinking, what do I need to do to continue to do my evil work? I'll just become the CEO of a global software company, and they have to like fight him. Although they haven't been alive since the 1800s, so they don't know anything about escalators and stuff like that. But that kind of like far out there idea that you present is very similar to Tom Holt's, like this, there's nothing that isn't, there's nothing that's sacred, don't stop.
Of course, yeah, definitely. I think stuff like that, like one cool little quirky idea can quickly spiral into, you know, you can get your imagination going, and before you know it, you've got a whole story out of, like you say, Vikings come back and a CEO wizard is, you know, Just those small things can quickly spiral into a really, really good story.
Yeah, and I think what I tell my students when we talk about creative writing is that just don't censor yourself.
Yes. One of the best writing advice that I've heard is give yourself permission to suck. So don't be afraid of writing something that's awful, because worst case scenario, you don't have to show anyone it. You can still write it, and you can have a look the next day and go, yeah, that's terrible. I'll leave it. Or sometimes you can, like, something can rise from the ashes of it, can't it?
Mm. So before you started this project that you're working on now, I mean, had you published anything yourself or had anything in anthologies before?
I've dabbled in drabbles. Me and Joel started at the same time with Black Hair Press. And I've been published in What If, which was sort of a collection of short stories between, I think it was myself and 12 other authors. That was really cool. So that was the book that I got sort of, obviously Drabble's is nice, but getting What If, I got paid for that one, so that was really cool. It's sort of like that first bit of, oh, you know, yeah, sort of qualified for, you know, something. I won a international short story competition, which was quite good. That was for a Canadian press. That was quite cool. And then I finished my the first draft of my novel, which was the main one I was working on throughout, which is a bit of a personal accomplishment for me, because it's something that when you go through all that time, it's just nice to finish it and have it. And even though I've not done anything with it, just finishing it was you know, something I was quite proud of.
Is horror your main genre?
I would probably say a mixture of horror, fantasy, and then maybe sci-fi, but probably a light sci-fi, I'd say. I quite like, I'd say probably sort of Dune. I quite like things like that. But I was remember the first audiobook I ever got was a science fiction book, and I thought, I love science fiction, I'll get a science fiction book. And the way it was set out was entries from computers talking to each other, and the series were numbered, dated, and not time stamped. And so the audiobook basically read them all out. And so it was these two computers talking to each other at the start, and it would go entry 10772 at 10:45, 2047. Hi. And then it'd be the next one and just read out another entry. And, you know, I took it out for a while because it was fun, but at the same time, you can only listen to so many 10101010101 before you get sick to the back teeth. So I had to put that one down. And then I started exploring fantasy, which was a genre that I never really thought I liked that much, because controversially, I've never been a big fan of Lord of the Rings. It just never really appealed to me for whatever reason. But then I got into Wheel of Time, and then I explored things like Name of the Wind, and just Song of Ice and Fire as well. Just exploring little things. My friend is big on fantasy, so he kind of put me in the right direction of certain books. And yeah, I would say fantasy is a big one for me. But yeah, I do like horror as well. I think I'm a bit of a melting pot in a way.
I categorize myself as a genre fiction writer.
Oh, yeah. Is that what we're called?
Yeah.
The official title.
You have literary fiction, which is basically, you know, Dickens when he's not writing ghost stories, and then and Austen and all those, and then you have genre fiction, which is basically the you know, whatever the stuff that does that has a clear genre definition. Yes. And I always, and I've said this before on this podcast, that I always kind of like considered myself a fantasy author, because that was what I always wanted to write, until I realized that I wasn't really that good at it. Until I like started writing, you know, Drabbles and short stories, and kind of like honed the craft, because as a fantasy author, you're always taught, or you believe that you're always supposed to write this epic first.
Yes, that's where I think, you can get
that
you
is the wrong way to go by it.
Yeah. And like you say, I think in a way, fantasy short stories are quite hard, because you tend to, it's about the journey, isn't it, in a way? And it's about that development of this guy's getting more powerful, or whatever it is. Or, it's about growth in a way, isn't it?
Yeah. I've kind of found a solution to that, because I've already created a fantasy world where all my fantasy stories are set.
That's cool.
Just that they can all be set in different countries in the same world.
Yes.
So we were talking about this shared world, and that's kind of like what mine is. It's like this one world, and sometimes the characters will refer to stuff that is happening in another country or another nation, kingdom, or whatever it is that I might have written about before, or I might intend to write about later.
That's cool. And the good thing about that is, because it's gossip, if it is predicting what happens in the future and you change it slightly, it's still canon, because it's just hearsay, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think that kind of solved that problem. I think I learned it from playing like Dungeons and Dragons, the Swedish version of Dungeons and Dragons, where they have, because I haven't actually played that much AD&D. I've only basically played the Swedish version of it.
Is it GURPS?
No. GURPS is no. This one's called. It's in the Swedish, in English translation, it would be Dragons and Demons is what the name of it is, and it's like a whole, like, it's based on Dungeons and Dragons from the beginning, but it also has its own, it's evolved into its own thing. And there they have like different nations that slightly resemble, like one slightly resembles maybe Greece during antiquity, one resembles maybe Italy during the Renaissance.
That's cool.
And they're all the people. And so that's kind of what my idea was, that, I mean, if I have nations in the north, maybe they can be, you know, some of them might be Scandinavian, some of them might be more native, like, you know, Inuit or whatever, and maybe there's like an Australian version. And so that's what kind of what, and then I set a story in these individual territories, whatever I need to, the story that I need to tell.
I think it's a really good thing to do, because you've got this rich world that you can always, you can just dip in and out, and you know it all, you know all the inner workings of how it works. So almost as you're writing it, I often find, and I imagine, you know, you were one of the people who do these shared worlds. The story almost in a way takes on a life of its own and writes itself, because you know how these things roughly work, but a bit like when you had characters interviewing themselves, you don't know what their answers are going to be. That just, it just comes out of your head, doesn't it? You don't really know what you're going to answer until it's out. And it's a bit like that with writing in a way. And I think that's what I enjoy about writing. It's weird self, because you're essentially exploring yourself, aren't you, in a weird way?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's, because you always say write what you know, and then sometimes you're thinking like, well, what do I know of living in a fantasy world where there are dragons? Well, nothing. Yeah. But my characters know what that's like, because they do it. And I think that's kind of fun, because I love world building.
Yes, definitely.
That's my favorite part, and it's kind of like, so I think the whole world that I built, I took like a year to construct it, because I have like how every single nation is governed, like who the leader is, if they have a religious leader, what religion it is, and then different, there's like one world religion, there's one religion that's kind of like Christianity,
yeah,
but then there are a bunch of other natural smaller religions and versions of that. And I think that's like, that's fun. And then, because I have all that saved.
Well, it can completely change the character. If you took the same character, but they had completely different religious beliefs, it would fundamentally change their actions throughout the book. So that in itself is it's like a second layer of characterization, isn't it?
Yeah. So is that the same with 45? I mean, do you have everything planned out?
In a weird way, what I tend to find is that I'll have a broad idea of where I want to be. And this happened with my novel as well. So my novel was supposed to be act one became book one, because I ended up, once I got into it and got into the characters, I wanted to explore more and do more. And I think I think that is what happens to me. And so where I wanted to originally be with Floor 54 now looks like it will be probably about 10 years away, because... what was the books that I'm going to be putting out as a detective series were going to be novelettes, which was going to be longer stories than normal, but not novel length. And they've sort of grown into novel length as I've been writing them and as I've been exploring them, where they do these mystery cases and solve them one at a time. And it's all ready to go. And I've got characters that I know I won't use for a long time that, they were part of the original crew. So the detective books explore Agent Radford and Agent Stone. It's set in the 80s. And so Agent Stone is almost like a broken man in the modern day. And it's almost exploring what happened to this happy-go-lucky guy who wore his emotions on his sleeve. How did he go from that to you know, this? But I've almost mapped out, I think I'm going to have probably around 8 at a minimum, maybe more. I don't know how many to push it with really. I've got the next 3 planned pretty well, I think. But then it's almost at what point do we find that event that triggers it all off? Because there is darkness and there is horror, but it's the banter between the two agents is relatively lighthearted and quite, I've tried to make it quite fun and a bit of a romp. in this horror world, so you've almost got people going missing, and you see how they go missing. That's the horror element. But the detectives, when you're with the detectives, it's quite fun, and until it's not, I suppose.
That's funny, because that's an interesting way to play it, because I was thinking I wrote a fantasy. Basically short story. It was, I think it ended up being 15,000 words. Also, and supposed to be actually like a trilogy of little novelettes about two characters that, you know, and the first one is where they meet, and one of them's a shapeshifter and one of them's a elemental magician, and they just happen to meet after like a battle scene where this shapeshifter manages to save the elemental magician. And then there's like this, there's blood everywhere. The state's just like completely mangled everybody. There's blood. And what I wanted to do was kind of create an image of these two characters being total sociopaths so that they don't react to what they've done. Because, I mean, the elemental magician does some spells and kills some people, you know, light, sets them on fire. And
that
then
is
they
very kind of
like, they just kind of like, you know what? So how are you doing? Oh, I'm fine.
Yeah.
What about you? But like, how about all these travelers that are dead? Your friends? Like, oh, they're not my friends. I just kind of hitched a ride. We were going in the same direction. So, you know, it's fine.
Is it almost like the classic fantasy novel is happening to the side characters in the background? And yeah, these two are just, that's quite cool. I quite like that.
And unfortunately, when I sent it in to the publisher for it, they didn't get that aspect of it.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like I needed to, I didn't want to explain it because I don't want to say, be like the writer that's like, yeah, well, this is what it was really like.
It's a bit like a joke, isn't it? If you have to explain a joke, it's not funny anymore, is it?
Yeah.
It's the same thing with the story, really.
Yeah, and I was like hoping I'll just rewrite a couple of other scenes because some other things that needed to be fixed. But I just wanted these two characters like to be completely, you know, sociopathic because they come to a town, the town has been ravaged, the town people need help, and they're just like, yeah, well, I don't really know if they want to help you guys. And in the end they do anyway, and they take these other young villagers with them. It's just like, yeah, fine, you can come along, it's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
And those guys get killed and they're just like, yeah, well, that's kind of what happens when if you're not ready.
Well, I think there is an element of that in fantasy anyway, isn't it? So I think you could it sounds like it sounds good to me. you'll get. I think everyone in fantasy, you want to see, you know, you want to see the hero burn the evil, you know, Trollocs or whatever it's going to be, and you want to see violence, don't you? But at the same time, like you say, there's another story on the other side, isn't there? The flip side, yeah, of the people getting burnt alive for, you know, probably just trying to do whatever they were doing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think so. I mean, I'm going to work on it again, but I mean, I have so many other projects, so that's not going to happen. But I think that kind of like the juxtaposition between the lightheartedness between the main characters and the horror that they kind of face, it's intriguing to me. Just like my shapeshifter character does not know what happens to his clothes when he changes shape.
Okay.
Because they come back. I mean, he comes back. So the elemental magician is just like, so what happens to your clothes when you shift? And the shapeshifter is just like, you know what? I never thought of it. They just kind of vanish and they just kind of reappear.
Maybe they're part of him. Maybe they're the bits to morphing in.
He's just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think that just has to be the way it is sometimes. People don't, if you do something often enough since you've been a child, do you really know why it happens?
You wouldn't think about it, would you? No, you wouldn't think about it.
No.
Joel's got a good rule that I like to do, which is as long as you, when you're writing it, as long as you've got a vague idea of why, which is, that's something that I try and do myself. Because when I first started, there was a lot of, he'd ask me like, what does happen when this happens? And I'm like, dunno. and whilst it can be intriguing at first, I think what happens is you don't get that payoff in the end when you find out. It's all well and good being intriguing. But if there's no payoff at the end where you do sort of find out, or if there's any inconsistencies, that's when things can be unsatisfying for the reader, isn't it?
Absolutely. I agree. Well, our time is winding down here. And I don't think we need to talk about what you're working on right now, because that's what we've been talking about the whole time. But what are your plans for your work in progress or your novel that, you know, when is it going into editing phase? Is it going to be beta read? Is it, you know,
Do you mean the novel? Because I've got the novel that's coming up in the Floor 54 world.
Yeah.
And then I've got the one that's sort of like the debut one that was the original one before all this happened. That one's sort of been shelved for now. I realised I'd bit off more than I could chew, and I'm really happy with it. And I read parts of it the other day actually, and I was like, oh, this, you know, it's got there's something in this. You know, when you find something of your own, it doesn't suck. It's always a good sign, isn't it?
It is,
because normally you're your own worst critic, aren't you, as you read stuff. But I think it was a bit too bold and ambitious for a first project, and I think I didn't have the ability to tell the story accurately enough yet. I need to remove at least one point of view character. I need to remove about 50,000 words of it. And part of me also was a bit worried of like, even if I go through all that and even if I do all that work, if it doesn't get accepted by a publisher, then what? Mm. So that's why I've almost like pursued this self published work in a world that I've made almost as a bit of, you know, if worse comes to worse, I've had some practice, I've enjoyed doing it, and you know, I've told some stories that at least I enjoy. You know, so there's that element, and the fact that you've got some control over it. Whereas with traditional publishing, obviously it's nice if I can get that, but I don't think it's realistic with the previous book at the minute. Yeah, I think there'd be a lot of editing work to get it publishable.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if a publisher thinks that the story is interesting enough,
they'll work with you.
They'll take it on and work with you. That's always something. So loving at least to query it and to try to polish up the three first chapters.
Yeah, do you know what? So I got put off because a lot of these word count caps and people saying that if it was over 100,000 words, most agents won't even look at it.
Really?
And yeah, that's why I bet if I was reading the wrong stories or something. Anyway, I just read loads of these stories basically saying that it wouldn't ever be even looked at really, which was a bit disheartening. At the same time, I'd written a short story, just a very short story for a science fiction magazine, and submitted that. And I got one science fiction magazine in mind, so I only submitted to one. So I've only ever done one proper submission. And I didn't get a reply back on it for like 2 months. And I looked at this, there's a website called, I think it's the Submissions Grinder, I think it's called, where you can sort of see the average response times and you can track the progress of your submission and blah, blah, blah. And the average response time was like 7 days. So I was like, must be, you know, it's at least made it to the slush pile. It's, you know, so part of me was like, I think I'm in. And I looked back at all the previous responses, and so you can see every response the company's ever made. And what I probably do is overthink and overanalyze things as an engineer. And so I was looking at the responses, and everything under 10 was generally a reject, and everything above 10 was normally an accept. So part of me was like, I've got this. And I remember I was basically having a particularly bad day at work, and I'd gone to McDonald's to kind of in my lunch break to try and make myself feel a bit better and eat some pizza. Yeah. And I get an email. So I have a look at the email, and it was a rejection. And part of me was like, that's cool. Okay, fair enough. But the other part of me was almost like added to the bad day.
Yeah.
And it was almost like two months in a rejection. It just said, you know, we liked your story, but it was not quite a fit for what we're looking for at the minute. So it was a really gentle rejection. Mm-hmm. And when I realized that I couldn't even handle that, part of me was like, you don't need to do this with your main, the love of your life, passion.
No.
Because it will break you.
Yeah. That was like the first thing that I, one of the first things that I sent in was a drabble. But I actually sent in something first and hadn't heard back in like forever. And I did get accepted to that later. But the response time was horribly slow.
Yeah.
But then I got, it was also a Canadian publisher, and I got, you know, the first, I just like, oh, I'll just send this in. I don't know. I'd never done a drabble before. Just give it a try. First thing I get back is like a rejection. It's like, oh crap. Oh, well, that was that writing career. And then I got a response afterwards, like an email just like a couple of minutes afterwards. I was just like, oh, sorry, I sent the wrong email. Your story has been accepted.
Wow.
Like, what?
That's crazy. On that sort of vein, we had the opposite happen to us at work. So we've got an apprentice. He's a proper good lad. He honestly blows it away. And so we submitted him for like the local apprentice.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. And he didn't win that. I think he qualified for it, but didn't win it. And we got an email come through saying that he'd been chosen as one of the finalists for Apprentice of the Year UK-wide for this governing body. And so we're like, oh my God. And they said, do you want to come to this event? Unfortunately, it's going to be a Zoom event this year, but you know, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, yeah, you've got to do it. It'd be great for, you know, your career and stuff. And so we were hyping him up and he was like, yeah, go on, we'll do it. And then we got an email back after we'd accepted saying, sorry, that email went out wrong. All the non-finalists have been sent emails saying they were finalists.
No.
So absolute disaster. You just couldn't believe it.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible. Oh, well, so where can people find you if they want to, you know,
it's probably the best place
to talk to you? Stuff.
Yeah, floor54.co.uk is probably the best hub. And then on that, you can sort of click the social buttons. Email is floor54@gmail.com. Twitter is twitter.com/floor54. I've just started a Facebook that's only got my wife and Joel on. I've not sent it out to any sort of, you know, the main people yet, or even family or friends. So it's like a secret, top secret group. But I think there's one button somewhere that lets you get to it. But I wanted it for the placeholder because I wanted everything to be Floor 54.
Yeah.
On Facebook, somebody's already snagged it. So I had to get Floor 54 official. So that's the problem with that one. So I had to almost get this placeholder in just to get it. I'm not doing anything with it.
I wonder what that is then.
I think it's a furniture store, okay. Which is really weird because the original like work in progress name for this was Floor 34 on the furniture store. That was the original working title name. And then it became Floor 34 and then it became Floor 54. Hmm. So yeah, furniture store.
Well,
maybe that's where I got the original idea from.
It could be. You've passed Floor 34.
No, I don't know.
Yeah, you never know what subliminal messages come.
That's the thing. One of my biggest fears is writing something down and realizing it's a blatant ripoff of something that I've not clocked.
Yeah, and I think that's why I'll sometimes consciously rip off stuff just because I want to be safe that I'm ripping off something that nobody's heard of. That's usually true. What I do is since I studied literature, I have all these like old texts from like between the 1700s to like sometime between like the 1950s. I like these old like crazy short stories that are just like bonkers. Sometimes I use them in my teaching. It's just like this is actually a good way to kind of write the start of the beginning of a story. It's like intriguing. Sure. Look at this, or look at what they do here. And sometimes I'll just rip stuff of that like completely off because sometimes it's just too good.
Yeah. But
nobody's going to read The Secret Brotherhood by Le Voleur from 1901.
Of course, yeah. No, like you say, there can't be many people who would know of it, really.
Yeah, so... But,
it's weird to think there's all these stories that are lost to time, isn't it?
Yeah. And we were talking about that today because we were reading something. I had the students read an excerpt from I think he's a British author named William Le Cure, and he was very famous during his day. He wrote hundreds of stories in all different kinds of genres, probably the best selling of that age in early 1900s. But today it's not unreadable, but you can tell like he's talking in like one scene. He's talking about how you wouldn't recognize a doctor can very seldom recognize a patient if they're not in a patient setting.
Sure.
Because you'll see a man will have, you know, a beard and look all pale, you know, pale and stuff like that. And then he was saying like, and women, they'll have their hair all let down and they won't wear chic modern hats and a nice frock. And I was just like, well, yeah, that doesn't really work today.
Yeah, and unfortunately, language barriers are hard to get through, never mind cultural barriers.
Yeah, yeah. So I think some of those things are lost to time because they're actually stuff that they say is completely irrelevant today.
Yes, definitely.
And unfortunately, that is the problem with those books.
I think when I've dabbled with literary fiction, that's been the barrier to entry for me in a way. It's sometimes you can see the good story beneath, and when it's good, it really hooks you in, but those moments where the language is different or it's referring to something that is no longer relevant, it can be difficult to get past it. It almost takes you out of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Although sometimes equally it can push you back in, can't it?
It can. It's stuff, especially if the stuff that you're especially interested in and you know something about, then it can be. I always tell the students that, you know what, no matter what you write, try to be relatable.
Yes.
Because that's what your readers are going to react to.
Yes.
Being relatable. And it can be as simple thing as saying, like, have you ever thought of thinking of a song that you haven't heard in ages, and all of a sudden it comes on the radio? Because yes. that's one of those things that we all
it's happened to everyone
experience.
Hasn't it?
Yeah. So it's like, oh yeah, yeah, I do know that, and then instantly you have a relationship to the author and between the author and reader.
I think if you can make someone think, or if you can make them feel something, then you've that's half the battle as an author, isn't it? Really?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Ryan, thank you very much for dropping by. It's been a great talk. I'll hope to talk to you again, especially maybe when your novel comes out, whatever you self-publish it or whatever, come back and promote it.
Perfect. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
it's been great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Great interview, great talk. And we actually continue talking after that. It's, it's just kind of continued even for another 20 minutes after the interview was done. Great talking to Ryan and all his ideas. And don't forget to go visit Floor 54 to look at his share world and all that ideas. I also think that I talked a lot in that interview, but that is as it is. I'd like to thank Ryan Hunt for stopping by and talking to us, and wish him well in everything that he's doing, and hopefully his wife does not have COVID. I would also like to thank John Holtman for providing the music, and all to all you listeners out there for listening to us and sharing this pod, taking it to the next level and everything like that. No particular news to put out there. Face of Fear, still out, still available. There has been some issues with the print versions. I guess the backing of it was not to Amazon's liking, so that has been rectified, and hopefully they'll be available soon. And all of you who ordered physical copies from the Breaking Rules publishing website should be able to get your copies real soon. And I think that's it. For Christian Mayer Hultman, my name is Christian Mayer Hultman, and I hope to see you next time here on The Guild.